Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 18th of August, these are our main stories. A bloody attack on a wedding party in the Afghan capital Kabul. A landmark deal between Sudan's military and the civilian opposition. And communists in Moscow call for free and fair elections, but our correspondent in the city is bemused.
They're demanding honest, clean elections. Although some of the images here seem to be at odds with that message. And I didn't think that honest, clean elections were a priority for Joseph Stalin.
Also in this podcast, the award-winning animator behind Who Framed Roger Rabbit has died. And the row over the disputed region of Kashmir goes global. First, shortly before we recorded this edition of Global News, we began to get reports of a big explosion in the Afghan capital Kabul. It went off inside a hall where a wedding was being celebrated. Initial reports suggest there are many casualties. Sultan Fazi of the Los Angeles Times is in Kabul.
The eyewitness that I spoke to, he was passing by the road. He said that he heard a very loud blast coming from that hotel. And immediately he noticed that people are running out of the wedding hall. They are looking for their close members of their family, especially children. This is happening in a neighborhood where Shiite minorities are basically residents. This is also taking place after a bloody attack took place back last year on 15th August, that was also in a Shiite minority school that killed dozens of students. So this is not clear whether who was behind the attack, but it's certain that the attack took place in a wedding hall where all the Shiite people were participating. The number of casualties could be very high due to the rush of the participants. So it is a first, I could say, in my life that I have been hearing as an Afghan that blast is taking place in a wedding hall that is targeting mostly civilians, especially women and children.
Sultan Fazi of the LA Times. Next to Sudan, where there have been celebrations to mark the signing of a landmark power-sharing agreement between military and civilian leaders. Tagreed Abdin of the Sudanese Professionals Association, one of the pro-democracy groups that took part in the protests that eventually led to the deal, hailed Saturday's agreement as a positive step forward.
Today is a cause for celebration. We've worked very hard to reach this point, even if the agreement itself might not be perceived as ideal, but we've come a very long way from where we were even 1 year ago. So yes, today is a cause for celebration and for optimism.
Our correspondent Sally Nabil is in Khartoum. I asked Sally what the deal contains.
This is the constitutional declaration that paves the way for forming a civilian government and a three-year transitional period. After the signing that took place today, a sovereign council is due to be formed tomorrow, which is going to lead the country during the three-year transitional period. It's formed of both civilians and military men. We expect a prime minister to be appointed in a couple of days, and then a cabinet of 20 members, 20 civilians, will be formed before the end of the month.
And Sally, does everyone agree this is the right way forward? Is everyone behind this?
Most of the people are, most of the political parties are. There are some parties who disagree, who refuse to recognize the constitutional declaration. For example, the Communist Party here says that this declaration does not pave the right path for a civilian government and that the military men, they are still part of the political landscape.
The new government has got to actually be able to sort out some of the problems facing people in their everyday lives.
Huge problems here in Sudan. I mean, we are speaking about an inflation rate of over 50%, chronic shortage of basic supplies. I mean, if you pass by any gas station, you would find long queues of people waiting for petrol. prices are very high, so just the day-to-day life thing is becoming increasingly difficult for the Sudanese people. And when I talked to people a short while ago, they all talked about their daily needs, about high prices, about education, about healthcare. And some of them told me, we've been very patient, we've waited for too long.
Sally Nabil with me from Khartoum. The dominant figure in Sudan's ruling military council is General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, better known as Hemeti. Although his official title is Vice President of the ruling military council, he's widely seen as the most powerful man in the country. He's been talking to the BBC's Zainab Badawi, who asked if the military could be trusted to stick to the agreement.
In accordance with the agreement, we will stick to every single letter we have agreed on. Secondly, even without the agreement, we have to work in this direction because it's in the country's interest. It's not our own interest. Therefore, we have to carry out the agreement, stick to it, and support it.
She also asked the general about those mass killings in June, which were blamed on the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, which he commands. And this was his response.
This is also an important question. After the Rapid Support Forces sided with the Sudanese people, those forces started to be targeted by systematic plotting and conspiracy to get them out of the scene. And they managed to create a rift between the people and Rapid Support Forces. They actually succeeded in that program. That was a very big plot. That plan was meant to be followed by a coup, particularly during the dispersal of the sit-in. A ready-made coup was to follow. But we didn't pay attention and we continued to assume our responsibility. But we had work to do and some information to gather until we found out who made those forces look like a killer rather than a protector.
General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. Thousands of people have attended a rally in Moscow organised by Russia's Communist Party calling for free and fair elections. It's the latest in weeks of protests in the capital after the authorities barred opposition candidates from running in local elections next month. More than 2,000 demonstrators have been detained in recent weeks. Our correspondent in Moscow is Steve Rosenberg.
I'm at a rally in Moscow that's been organised by the Russian Communist Party and other left-wing groups. They're demanding honest, clean elections, although some of the images here seem to be at odds with that message. And I didn't think that honest, clean elections were a priority for Joseph Stalin or the Soviet Union. But anyway, these kind of slogans, free and fair elections, an end to political persecution, these are the kind of slogans we've been hearing at political rallies in Moscow in recent weeks. And there's one slogan here, it says that corruption begins with dishonest elections. I get the feeling that the Communist Party is trying to jump onto the protest bandwagon. But there are far fewer people here today than there were at last week's opposition rally, which was in the same place. Still, keep an eye on the communists, because I think the Communist Party could benefit from the general wave of protest sentiment across Russia right now. Next month, Muscovites will be voting for a new parliament in their city. A whole string of opposition candidates, Kremlin critics, have been barred from taking part. But there'll be plenty of communist candidates in that election, and the Communist Party is hoping to pick up the protest votes of Muscovites. Well, across the city, it's a very different scene. The opposition wasn't given permission to hold a rally this weekend, so instead, people have decided to hold what they call single picket protests. So individuals holding up placards calling for independent candidates to be allowed to take part in the Moscow election. And for now, the police seem to be keeping their distance. We expect that protests will continue in Moscow in different forms right up to the election on September the 8th.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. Thousands of teachers took part in a rally on the streets of Hong Kong on Saturday as pro-democracy protests there enter their 11th week. Braving heavy rain, the black-clad teachers marched under the slogan, "Safeguard the next generation, let our conscience speak." Ipkin Yuen of the Teachers Professional Union said his delegates had felt compelled to take action.
I think the teachers are angry because, you know, the government is making a lot of mistakes, and including they are treating the next generation badly. no matter in suppressing the protest using excessive forces. And also, you know, the whole thing, the extradition bill, is a mistake.
The teachers' rally passed off peacefully, but why have other protests in Hong Kong become so violent? And what underpins the anger we're seeing on both sides? Dr. Christian Chan is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Hong Kong.
Over the weeks, we've seen escalation in both the tactics used and in the rhetoric used by both sides. We see that in the police side, they're describing protesters as cockroaches. And on the other hand, protesters are describing police as dogs. And that seems to be translating in the kind of methods and the tactics and the level of violence that they are using against each other. And also we see that there are a lot of online bullying as well. So I think given dehumanization that we're seeing, as well as the sort of like an arms race, if you will, across these two groups, I think that accounts for part of the escalation in violence.
So both sides are trying to portray the other side as other, as something else.
Right. And of course, this is a battle of identity as well. A lot of people are describing some of the police officers as not Hong Kongers. They suspect that we have some decoyed military officers from mainland China, and that this identity of Hong Kong, who is a Hong Konger and who isn't, seems to be playing into the escalation as well.
In the course of this 11 weeks, there have been occasions where hundreds of thousands have come out onto the streets, I think 2 million on one occasion. And that was very much an intergenerational march. But the core protesters are young people. And what is it about the way in which they have grown up in Hong Kong, many of them since the handback of Hong Kong to China in 1997? What is it about their upbringing, do you think? Or is there anything about their upbringing that makes them the kind of protesters that they are today?
I think that the general impression is that the sense of hope within the city in terms of their career options and in terms of the living conditions seem to be pretty grim. In particular, as everyone knows, Hong Kong remains the most unaffordable place to live in terms of the private housing market. Even though close to 50% of residents in Hong Kong live in some form of subsidized housing, the quarters are generally very small, and that I think young people also feel like in their day-to-day life, a lot of the policies that were made, a lot of the things that they see on the street, and especially in tourist areas, the neighborhoods that they grew up in seem to have transformed in a way that do not cater to their interests or needs, but rather is catering to tourists from, especially tourists from mainland China. So I think there has been this brewing underlying discontent among young people.
With a hardening of position on both sides, how do you see this conflict being resolved?
I think no one has the answer right now. That's the problem. But I think a lot of people have asked both sides to consider a truce. Most Hong Kong people, whether they are actively involved in the protests or not, are quite exhausted, both physically and mentally. Initially, most of these clashes, they were pretty contained within certain regions in Hong Kong, and they are mostly happening over the weekends. But more and more so, they are now being spilled over to other districts, and including the airport, as well as into the weeknights. And so that is really taking a toll on a lot of people's mental health, as some of these recent reports have shown. And so we really need a break, and perhaps a week-long truce would be helpful so that both sides can get some sleep and get some rest and reconsider what are the best strategies forward.
Dr. Christian Chan talking to Julian Marshall. And still to come on this edition of the Global News Podcast.
I think we've discovered that, like most things, you know, the rocket ship doesn't care if you're a boy or girl.
Why, it may be a woman who next steps on the moon. A group of 27 teenagers has been allowed to disembark on the Italian island of Lampedusa after more than 16 days at sea aboard a Spanish rescue ship. The Italian Coast Guard took them ashore, but more than 100 other migrants remain on board the vessel, which has been anchored off the coast for 3 days. Our Europe regional editor Mike Sanders told me more.
The Italian Interior Minister, Matteo Salvini, had been pretty adamant up to now that nobody would be getting off this boat because he doesn't want migrants coming to Italy. He wanted it to go elsewhere. And in fact, before this group was taken off the boat, he did put out a tweet saying that Open Arms, the charity that brought them to Italy, could have easily taken them to Spain, which is where they're based, in the 16 days that they've been at sea. He's now said that they can allow what he called the alleged miners off the boat. And looking at the pictures, they do seem to be a group mainly from sub-Saharan Africa.
So there are still people on board this vessel. It's still not being allowed to dock in Lampedusa. And from what we know, the conditions on board are pretty awful.
It's been bobbing about at anchor for about 3 days, not counting the time it was actually in the open sea. You can use your imagination, really. It's a boat that's got a crew of 19. That's what it's designed for. And it's got very limited toilets and washing facilities. 105 migrants on board. But listen to me. Let's listen to Oscar Camps, who's the founder of Open Arms. This is what he had to say about it.
The situation on board is out of control. It's beyond our capacity to deal with it. Yesterday, we communicated to the caretaker Prime Minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, the French President Emmanuel Macron, and the President of the European Parliament, David Sassoli, and all the Italian authorities that from today, we cannot be held responsible nor guarantee the security of the people on board the Open Arms. Not the 134 migrants nor the 19 volunteer crew who have been held hostage on board the Open Arms. It is impossible to keep calm.
So who decides, Mike, what happens now to the vessel and the people on board?
Well, it's a bit of a tug of wills, if you like, between Matteo Salvini, the Interior Minister, on one hand, and European countries. Six of them have, in fact, offered to take in some of these migrants, but they have also been caught up in a political row within Italy. Matteo Salvini tried to bring down the government 10 days ago because he wants to ditch his collaboration with the five-star populist party because he's riding very high in the opinion polls. This has kind of backfired on him now, and these migrants have become a bit of a symbol of this squabble between five-star and Mr. Salvini's party, the League.
Our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders. Now, much has been made of this year's 50th anniversary of man's first step on the moon. It's now looking increasingly likely the next human to walk on the lunar surface could be a woman. President Trump has set 2024 as the target date for American astronauts to return to the moon, and the head of the US space agency NASA has said his ambition is to put the first woman on the moon. Nicole Stott is a retired NASA astronaut who's flown two spaceflight missions herself.
I think it's really important. You know, we've over time seen women doing more and more things with the space program. And I think we've discovered that, like most things, you know, the rocket ship doesn't care if you're a boy or girl. And these days within NASA, at least the NASA astronaut office, I think we've got about 36% women astronauts in the office and all equally as talented and trained as any of the men.
Sue Nelson is a science journalist and the author of Wally Funk's Race for Space. So the inevitable first question, not where, but who is Wally?
Wally Funk was a member of a team of women. They were all pilots, all American, in the early 1960s, who between 1960 and 1961 took the physical astronaut tests, exactly the same tests that the American male pilots had taken to be selected as America's first astronauts. And because 13 women passed those exact same tests, they're now retrospectively known as the Mercury 13. So Wally Funk is a member of Mercury 13, who could have been, if history had been a bit kinder, because none of the women ever went into space, Wally could have been the first woman on the moon.
Why wasn't history kinder to women?
Basically, it was right stuff, wrong sex, wrong time in history. At that time in the early 60s, although there were women involved in the space program and far more that we're learning about now that were involved in mission control as engineers, the African-American women who were featured in the book and the film Hidden Figures, the job of an astronaut was seen as a very male occupation and profession, and not so much something that a woman should do. And NASA didn't actually admit women into its astronaut corps until 1978, you know, almost two decades later. And of course, the Russians beat America by getting the first woman into space in 1963 with Valentina Tereshkova.
So the Russians had a totally different attitude to the potential of females as astronauts.
They did at the time, although to be fair, I do think that it was sadly, in hindsight, also a token gesture, because it took nearly 20 years to put the second Russian female astronaut into space. And the only reason they hastened her trip into space was because they knew that there were women in the NASA astronaut corps for the first time. So the Russians knew then that America was soon going to put its first woman into space. And several months before Sally Ride did become the first woman into space, the Russians pipped them again by putting their second woman into space.
And of course, there is a big if isn't there, about the first woman on the moon in 2024. Very ambitious target, that.
Hugely ambitious. You know, people within NASA itself are, you know, have called it an aggressive deadline. Some people off the record will pour doubt on it and say it can't be done, because originally it was going to be 2028. So they've brought forward their own deadline. But as we know, sometimes by putting the pressure on, you can get extraordinary things done, as in fact happened with JF Kennedy and the moon landings itself. Either way, whether it's 2024 or not, definitely by the end of the decade of the 2020s, we will finally get the first woman on the moon.
Sue Nelson with Julian Marshall. For 2 weeks now, India and Pakistan have been at loggerheads over Narendra Modi's decision to revoke the special status afforded to Indian-administered Kashmir. Most of the region has been in lockdown. Hundreds of people, including local politicians, are in detention. It's a dispute now shaping life far from South Asia, though. Around the world, people of Pakistani origin have been protesting against India's actions. The UK has the biggest Pakistani Kashmiri population outside India. Many now live in the city of Birmingham in central England, from where Paul Moss reports.
What do we want?
Freedom!
What do we want?
Freedom! They called for freedom. They called for justice. 4,500 miles from India, in the English Midland city of Birmingham, people were protesting about the latest developments in Kashmir.
The people of Kashmir can't leave their houses, can't see their neighbour, they can't go and see any of their relatives down the road.
You know that the Indian government says it's just trying to impose law and order in a place which they consider part of India.
But isn't that the right of the people that are already living there to make that decision themselves? Kashmiri people are opposed to this.
There's a distinctive kind of protest going on now. They have an effigy of the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, and people are queuing up to hit the effigy with their shoes. Around them are a sea of Kashmir flags and slogans like Freedom for Kashmir. Another banner says Indian forces out, out, out.
The Indian government imposed all these curfews on the people by force. There's been internet blackouts as well. And I would say that feelings about Kashmir are strong in Birmingham.
Feelings are indeed strong here. Two city councillors of Pakistani origin have called for a boycott of Indian products, including Bollywood movies. And one of the Kashmir protest organisers goes further. Zubaida Begum wants a boycott of all businesses which are owned by people from Indian families.
We will not be dealing with businesses that are owned by Indian people.
Here in Birmingham?
Here in Birmingham or anywhere in UK. This is human right violation we're talking about.
But businesses here in Birmingham owned by people of Indian origin, they're not responsible for what's happening in Kashmir.
They are responsible because they're leaders. They've got leaders back home as well, same way we have.
This is not the first time that tensions in Kashmir have had repercussions on the streets of Britain. The 1950s and 60s saw tens of thousands of Pakistani immigrants come to the UK, many from the Pakistan part of Kashmir. There were some among them who helped form the militant group, the Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front. And two of its members then went on to kidnap and murder an Indian diplomat in Britain. But according to the writer Amardeep Bassi, the new generation of British Kashmiris is taking a more radical stance.
They've seen how their parents and grandparents and uncles have campaigned for an independent Kashmir for decades, and yet nothing has happened. In fact, in some ways, the problem has got worse. It's made them even more angrier, I suppose.
I visited a cafe in Birmingham, owned by a woman whose family comes originally from the Punjab area of India. She's a Sikh, but insists she has many friends of Pakistani origin. That said, when it comes to Kashmir, she supports the actions of the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi.
He's changed the laws in Kashmir, so that's a good thing. I think what he's done is good. He's given rights to women. So people do discuss it.
What do you think the Indian community here in Birmingham should do if there is a boycott of your businesses?
If it affects them, they should do the same. They should actually boycott Pakistani businesses as well then. So it's tit for tat, I think.
Any tit-for-tat response risks an escalation of tensions between British people of Pakistani and of Indian origin, precisely what many community leaders here are trying to avoid. But with the issue of Kashmir having such a hold on the South Asian diaspora around the world, the only solution, some here say, is for those with different views to sit down together and to try to reach some mutual understanding.
Paul Moss reporting from Birmingham. An orphaned dugong who became an internet star after being rescued in Thailand in April has died. Handlers say Mariam, one of only 800 dugongs in Thai waters, died of an infection caused by swallowing pieces of plastic. I asked our Asia Pacific editor Michael Bristow to explain what a dugong is.
It's a sea mammal, grows to about 3 metres in length. It eats seagrass. This particular dugong, there's only several hundred or so in the waters around Thailand, was orphaned from its mum earlier on this year, and it was looked after by sea life handlers and became rather famous after a video of it was shown in Thailand of it being fed by its handlers milk and seagrass. This one was particularly cute. It looked pink. It used to sort of like cuddle up to its handlers. And in fact, so much was the demand to see it that there was a 24-hour live streaming of this dugong and another one that had been picked up a few months afterwards. So you can imagine that in Thailand, there's a lot of disappointment at its death. When they carried out a post-mortem examination, they found out that it had eaten lots of pieces of plastic that had blocked up its intestines and caused the infection. So it's a case of essentially human pollution leading to the death of an endangered sea animal. And I'm sure that cases like this always raise awareness about those kind of issues.
So it becomes iconic in a way to illustrate the issue that so many people around the world are trying to draw attention to. It's happened through an animal that's cute and was already quite famous.
Exactly. There's been growing interest around the world in the amount of plastic pollution that gets into the seas. There have been a number of whales, many in East Asia, that have died, been opened up. They've had plastic bags inside. And this is just another example. And I'm sure it's going to have an effect of raising awareness.
Michael Bristow reporting. The animator and director behind iconic hits like Who Framed Roger Rabbit and The Pink Panther has died at the age of 86. Richard Williams was born in Toronto in Canada, but moved to the UK in the 1950s. His family says he died peacefully at home, having suffered from cancer. Rebecca Drought looks back at some of his work.
Richard Williams won 2 Oscars and a BAFTA for his work on Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Just Roger, he keeps blowing his lines!
A film that, in his words, tangled the cartoon with the live action. He's credited with creating several of the characters, including Roger himself and the toon femme fatale Jessica Rabbit. Speaking to the BBC around the time of the film's release in 1988, he explained that the style of animation hadn't been used before.
It's good old classical animation, but we found a way to make the things look round, you see, which hadn't been done before. You know, they always look flat, yeah. Pasted in. I was on it for 2.5 years. I was trying to design the rabbit for about 6 months, and the other new characters. And then we were in full-scale animation production for 14 months.
Roger Rabbit wasn't Richard Williams' first taste of success. His first film, The Little Island, released in 1958, scooped a BAFTA. and his animated adaptation of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol in 1971 saw him take home his first Oscar. He credited Disney's Snow White, which he saw at the age of 5, as inspiring him. At the age of 15, he spent 2 days at the famous studio after showing them his drawings. During a long career, Richard Williams created the title sequences to the original Casino Royale. A funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, and also animated 2 of the later Pink Panther films. He was said to be drawing until the day he died.
And that report came from Rebecca Drought. That's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. But if you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we included, do drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.